This is Lisa Dale Miller. You're about to hear a Dharma talk I gave on March 10, 2019 at Marin Sangha. The topic of the talk was twofold: the nature of teachers and their fallibility, and also the standards with which the Buddhist teachings hold teachers. The second part of the talk is on human beings who spend their lives engaged in wrongdoing, and then have recognition and realization and appear to have some kind of change. How do we as human beings hold these individuals accountable and yet not find a way to get lost in hatred? One of the themes of Marin Sangha is Dharma in daily life. Some of the people who know me and have known me for a long time will tell you sometimes my talks tend to go beyond daily life. There have been a couple of things on my mind. I thought I would talk about a couple of things that have shown up a bit more recently in the Buddhist world that have probably been concerning for people. Maybe some of you don't know about it or it hasn't been concerning for you. It's going to be kind of a two-part talk. The first part, I'm going to talk about the role of the guru. And second part, or your teacher. And the second part, I'm actually going to talk about people who've been consistently doing bad things and how they change and what happens for people who know them. So many of you may have seen the letter that was written by Spirit Rock about 3 weeks ago, making clear their position on Noah Levine, who started Against the Stream. He was a, I'd say, pretty long-time Buddhist teacher in the Theravada tradition. His whole path was using the Dharma in order to deal with and abate addiction. And Noah has done tremendous things for many, many people who suffer with addiction. The most recent great thing he did was he created Refuge Recovery, which is now everywhere, and it's a peer-led, Buddhist wisdom-oriented way of being able to have a sober community, like in the AA model, but it's really based on the Buddhist teachings. And it is peer-led, so honestly, he wrote this book, which is kind of the manual for how to do it, and didn't he want to put his name on it, honestly, and then just let it go. And Refuge Recovery is huge. But unfortunately, about a year and a half ago, there were some allegations that he had misbehaved misogynistically and sexually toward women in the Sangha, some women out of the Sangha. And honestly, for a long time, I've known several teachers who are women in Against the Stream, and there has been a misogynistic bent in Against the Stream toward the women teachers for a long time. But this went over the edge. This was sexual abuse behavior, and it is in the hands of the LAPD. Since then, Against the Stream is dissolved. It doesn't exist anymore. Most of the teachers have gone off and started their own things, so at least the Dharma from Against the Stream is continuing in other forms, and that's wonderful. And of course, Refuge Recovery is still as vibrant and alive as ever. But unfortunately, Noah has not behaved very well through all of this. And because he was a Spirit Rock teacher and teaching under the auspices of Jack Kornfield's blessing, Spirit Rock had to deal with this. They did see the allegations from the LAPD, and I guess the Teachers' Council got together, and they made a decision that he could no longer be part of the Teachers' Council, nor could he teach under the auspices of Spirit Rock. And they released this very beautiful letter to the community about this decision. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because of the last part of the letter. So they went through the whole explanation and basically said what the decision was. And then in the last part of the letter, it said, should Noah decide to recognize and actually have remorse and do some kind of repair, and then decide to come back onto the Buddhist ethical path and show consistency at some point in the future, we certainly will welcome him back. And I thought to myself, well, that actually has precedent in the Buddhist tradition. I know in here I've told you the story of Angulimala before, who was a crazy murderer that everyone was afraid of. And when the Buddha met him, he was just like, okay, you're a crazy murderer, but you're a human being. And that was it. Angulimala completely changed his life, became one of the monks. And in fact, I actually have some of the teachings that Angulimala gave. Clearly in the Buddhist path, there is always a recognition that we are all human beings and we are all imperfect. And we all have capacity to awaken out of our suffering. At the same time, of course, there was the whole thing with Sogyal Rinpoche, which has been going on for years, and how he's been doing all kinds of sexual misconduct with his students. Since the Me Too movement, all this stuff is coming out in the Buddhist world. I started to think, well, the guru thing, it's problematic. And then, in the last few days, some of you do know this, I was initiated into TM. And back then, in the early 70s, Maharishi was actually around. So, you know, we actually had contact with him. And I was very, very involved in the TM movement. I became a siddha at 18. And, you know, I was really seriously practicing among them until about 26. I kept doing all my practices, even though I was getting interested in Buddhism at that point. I had a very pure experience with Maharishi. Every time I was ever in his presence, I don't know how to describe it, it was beautiful. And maybe it was because I was so young. He was a very big part of my relationship with the spiritual path and being a meditator. So I was reading the New York Times the other day, and there was some article about, I don't know, someone who had started TM recently, and I'm always interested in what it's like to start now these days. And it's a little different. And it keyed me to another article about David Lynch, who has been a meditator a very long time. Believe me, there's all these famous people who started when I started and just kept meditating all these years. There was one point in this article about David Lynch, I'm gonna read this to you because it's so unthinkable to me when it comes to the guru. So it says, Maharishi seems to have disappeared from the conversation entirely. Many of those I interviewed who learned TM through Lynch's foundation compared the practice to going to the gym. Kevin Law, a former music industry executive who had been invited to join the foundation's board, told me that he was inspired by the fact that people like Martin Scorsese and Ray Dalio were very public that TM had changed their lives. Now, of course, these people started a long time ago. And then it goes on to say, Law said that for him, TM is more like working out. When I asked him about his sense of Maharishi, he said, I know shockingly little about him because it's not important. This was a shock, and not just about Maharishi, but maybe I've just been very fortunate. I have never had a teacher in the Buddhist tradition, any of my teachers, Philip Moffat, Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Roshi Joan Halifax, Ajahn Sumedho, and then over in the Dzogchen and Mahamudra world, Dzogchen Rinpoche, Minja Rinpoche, Anam Thubten, none of my teachers have ever crossed any lines with anybody I know, ever. They have always been a very big part of my practice. I have a tremendous amount of devotion for these individuals who have been able to shepherd me all these years through the ups and downs of my practices. And, you know, I'm one of these people who practices every day for at least an hour. I've been doing this since I was 16, and I'm going to be 61. So I have a very long relationship with all of this, and never have I ever had a teacher who's been anything other than a precious gem for me. And yet, there's so many people who've had other kinds of experiences with teachers of all kinds. And yet, the idea that people are actually learning this precious technique, TM goes all the way back to Shankara in 90 AD. It's profound to think that they don't have any sense of the lineage. When I was involved with the TM movement, just like the Buddhist movement, the lineage was important. It was extremely important where the teachings came from. And so I really started to think about the role of the guru with all of this. Although there isn't much guru yoga over here in the Theravada, but the guru is important. The Buddha's always up there. We're always teaching the teachings of the Buddha. We're always referring back to the teachings of the Buddha. So the guru is important. And I happened on an article that Stephen Batchelor had written a couple of years ago, who is another one of my Buddhist teachers. And he wrote the following. Before he died, Gautama, the Buddha, told his followers, "After I am gone, do not think you will have no teacher. The Dharma will be your teacher." Unlike a king, the Buddha did not expect any one person to be his successor. And if many of you probably know, the Dalai Lama has ended the lineage of the Dalai Lama. There will not be another Dalai Lama. He has said, it's done. So he's done the same thing the Buddha did. In the discourse to the Kalamas, the Buddha explicitly warned against believing something, quote unquote, because my guru said it. And actually, I think this is something that's very big in the Buddhist teachings. You don't just take what your teacher says. You see for yourself, is this true? Is this correct? Does this have validity? One of my teachers, Yongye Minchu Rinpoche, is very clear because guru yoga is part of the Nundo practice that he has his students do. And he's very clear when he teaches on guru yoga. Minchu Rinpoche basically says that the only reason for doing guru yoga, seeing your teacher as a Buddha, is in order to recognize how the same awakened qualities permeate yourself, all other human beings, and the very world in which we live. When you're doing guru yoga and you're visualizing the guru, and you're seeing the enlightened qualities of the guru, in fact, that's your own mind. And so all you are doing is seeing the enlightened qualities of your own mind and the mind of every other human being, because all other human beings are capable of awakening. The problem of giving over everything to the teacher has been a problem down through the ages, so much so that one of the things I found was a text called The Four Reliances, and this is in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Tibetan Buddhism is really wonderful at distilling the essence of the Theravada in these very pithy, like four-line verses. Rely not on the person, rely on the teaching. Rely not on the words, rely on the meaning. Rely not on what's cryptic, rely on what's clear. Rely not on opinion, rely on wisdom. So these four reliances are a recipe for how to recognize a worthy teacher. A non-worthy teacher will make it all about the cult of personality. And they will speak in a language that makes no sense. It's like something you should aspire to. It's not something you can just get. And that goes along with the crypticness. They're basically teaching based on their own opinion. They're not teaching from profound wisdom. I assure you, there's a perennial philosophy, and all truth looks the same. And wisdom is wisdom. And we know what wisdom feels like in our gut. And we know what opinion feels like in our gut. So Mipon Rinpoche wrote a commentary on the Four Reliances, which I would like to share with you. The first one, do not rely on the person, but rely on the Dharma, on the teaching itself. So he says, freedom comes from the genuine path that is taught, not the one who teaches it. When the teachings are well presented, it does not matter what the speaker is like. That's a double-edged sword, is it not? So here's where things get tricky. Because if you really took that to heart, you could have a speaker who's doing all kinds of stuff that just would not be in line with Buddhist ethics. And they might be speaking truth, yet their actions might not be in line with certainly the top number one Buddhist ethical consideration, which is non-harming. Even someone who's lost can be the communicator of great wisdom. I actually think Noah is probably a good example. Noah has imparted a lot of great wisdom, and yet, as a person, he's quite lost. But this is the Buddhist teaching, right? All beings suffer. Ignorance, greed, and hatred. This is just primordial ignorance, and we all have it in one way or another. And it's not a reason to hate. That's the key teaching of tonight. No matter what shows up, there is no reason to drop into hatred. That's just more suffering. You can recognize it's not wise, but you do not have to hate. Okay, so the second of the four reliances, do not rely on the words, but on the meaning. So Mipham Rinpoche says the following. Whenever you study or contemplate the Dharma, rely not on the words, but on the meaning. If the meaning is understood, then regardless of the speaker's style, there will be no conflict. So again, this is Mipham Rinpoche saying, the teacher may have a style you don't like, and yet, if the teacher is teaching the Dharma, the actual Buddhist teachings, there is a way to be able to land in the meaning. Now, of course, this may not be your chosen teacher. You may not ever go back to that teacher. In fact, you may be having that experience with me right now. But you may still get the definitive meaning of the teachings. The third of the four reliances, do not rely on the provisional meaning, but on the definitive meaning. Things exist in relative existence, and yet you might view them differently from the ultimate view of not self. So here's what Mipham Rinpoche has to say about this. The omniscient one, or the Buddha, that's how he refers to the Buddha, himself, in all his wisdom, taught according to students' capacities and intentions, presenting teachings of various levels, just like the rungs of a ladder. So when I'm here with you all, I teach at a very sophisticated level because most of you are longtime practitioners. If I teach for people who've never had any exposure to the Dharma, I would not be giving this teaching I'm giving right now. And so I can talk to you and I can deliver wisdom in a way that I would not be able to do for people who do not have any kind of frame for the Buddhist teachings. And then finally, the four reliances. Now we go a little into the territory where sometimes I do go with you guys. Do not rely on the ordinary mind, but rely on wisdom. So how do you know wisdom? Well, Mipham Rinpoche gives some advice about how to recognize wisdom. That which operates with conceptual ideas is the ordinary mind, whose nature involves perceiver and perceived. All that is conceived in this way is distorted and will never touch upon the actual nature of reality. Any idea of real or unreal, both or neither, any such concept, however it's conceived, is still only a concept. And whatever ideas we hold in mind, it is not by any assertion or denial that we will put an end to concepts. Once we see without rejecting or affirming, there is freedom. The teachings on not accepting, not rejecting, are very powerful when it comes to experiences like I had driving to work last week down the windy mountain road because Highway 17 was a mass of accidents in the middle of a storm. So when that happens, I leave my house and I go down this windy road to get to my office. And SiriusXM does not work on the windy road because there's lots of trees and mountain and So I couldn't listen to what I usually listen to, which is Dr. Radio, which I totally love. I turned on KQED, and there was Michael Cohen in the hearings. How many of you heard any part of the hearings? I normally don't get to hear these things because I'm usually in my office seeing patients. I had 9 minutes, and wow, it was the most amazing 9 minutes. When I tuned in, one of the Republican representatives was off on some tangent. Michael Cohen is a liar, and why should he believe him? After about 3 minutes of it, I thought, this is samsara. This man is so lost in samsara. Not only is he saying the same thing over and over again, but really, there's no purpose here. I'm sure he has some purposeful questions to ask this person. And at that moment, Michael Cohen stopped the guy in his tracks. And he said this, "You should not believe me. I have been before all of you before, and I lied. I did not tell the truth. So you should not believe me. And because you should not believe me, I have just spent weeks in my records gathering all of the paperwork, all the documents that shows all of this for all of you, and I've submitted them all, and you have them. So no, you should not believe me. Go," and he does this in the New York accent that I'm now using because I'm a New Yorker, "you should go read the documents." And I had an epiphany in that moment. I thought, that is such a Buddhist thing to do. Here's someone who's probably spent so many years behaving badly, and he's essentially bared himself. He's thrown himself on his sword, and he's just said, because I am a liar, do not believe me, and because that's the case, you have documents to prove it all, so this isn't about me. It was the ultimate act of selflessness. This is not about me. And I was stunned. And then my next thought was, what does a Buddhist do with someone who's behaved so badly and is throwing themselves on their sword and telling you that they have ostensibly decided to stop doing harm and do something good? How do you regard someone like that? And it really made me think. This landed me back in the article I read in the New York Times about David Lynch. Because for any of you who know David Lynch, he's a brilliant film director, but honestly, David has been producing films from the beginning which are deeply disturbing. In fact, I remember walking out of Blue Velvet. I remember I couldn't take it. I literally left. It must have been halfway through, and I left. I guess I was 23 at the time. I don't know. This is someone who's been practicing TM and is so devoted to getting others to practice. He has this foundation which gives away TM practice, TM teachings in the military, schools, for free. And he's been doing this for years and years and years, and yet the way he comports himself, the kind of material that he creates, it's not what we in the Buddhist world would call non-harming. There was another article in the New York Times about David Lynch. The person who was writing the article questioned him about this and had gone to a bunch of different events with him. And she said, "During our time together, I heard audiences ask Lynch over and over how he could create disturbing movies while dipping into a field of pure bliss. He had universally assured them that it was no problem. He has been meditating for years, and it actually helps him to be more creative, to come up with better, more visceral stories." I mean, what do you do with this? This is pure humanness. It's pure ignorance. And yet, this is coming from someone who is doing a tremendous amount of good in one way and totally unconscious about the harm that he creates in another way. So, of course, that led me back to Michael Cohen. Here's somebody who's done a tremendous amount of harm and apparently seems to be ready to not do harm any longer. That led me to dive deep into what is two-thirds of the teachings that were given by the historical Buddha, which is on ethical conduct. Yes, two-thirds of what is included in the suttas is on ethical conduct. And the ethical conduct is not just the Vinaya, which is the ethical conduct for the monks, but he did a lot of lecturing about ethical conduct for householders like us. So I thought you might be curious about what the Buddha had to say when it comes to what an ethical life looks like for people like us who live in the world. So I have several examples. The first one is from the Digha Nikaya, and this is the Sigalovada Sutta, or the Layman's Code of Discipline. And it's very interesting. I love the Buddha. He's such a politician in some ways, you know. Obviously, he was from a royal family. The way he titled this is The Four Winning Ways. Doesn't that make you want to do discipline? Wise and virtuous, gentle and keen-witted, humble and amenable, energetic and not indolent, in misfortune, unshaken, flawless in manner and intelligent, hospitable and friendly, liberal and unselfish, a guide, an instructor, a leader. Generosity, sweet speech, helpfulness to others, impartiality to all, as the case demands. Those are the four winning ways to behave as a layman with discipline and ethical conduct. Sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? Do any of you know someone who's like this? Yes, human beings really can do this. Because human beings really can do this, and because this is such a deep part of the heart of the Dharma, when teachers essentially don't pay attention to the ethical aspects of the teaching of the Dharma, I feel that they're doing their students a disservice. That it is very important for us to comport ourselves in an ethical manner in our lives in every way we possibly can, barring the fact that we are imperfect beings and we make mistakes too. But at least the effort should be there. Here's another example of the Buddha's teaching on ethical conduct for lay people like us. And this is from the Great Mangala Sutta. Associate with the wise and honor those who are worthy of honor. Do meritorious actions and set oneself on the right course. Have much learning, be skillful in handicraft, well trained in discipline, and of good speech. Support your parents, cherish your spouse and children, and engage in peaceful occupation. Be generous in giving, righteous in conduct, help your relatives, and be blameless in all your actions. Abstain from evil, refrain from intoxicants, be steadfast in virtue. Be respectful, humble, contented and grateful, patient and obedient. Listen to the Dhamma on occasion. I love that on occasion part. It's like, I know, you have to work, but come here on occasion. A mind unruffled by the vagaries of fortune, freed from sorrow, taints, and fear, those who thus abide ever remain invincible in happiness. So he's not talking about monks here. He's talking about us. To me, none of these things are unattainable. None of these things require enlightenment. At least I don't think so. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this. It just appears to me that what these things require is a sense of other-centeredness and a grounding in purpose and a commitment to being a light in a world of darkness. That's the reason to get up in the morning. Is to light the lamp of wisdom in a world of darkness. And to be able to drive down Old Santa Cruz Highway and turn on the hearings and have someone like Michael Cohen be your teacher. And he was my teacher that morning. He woke me up and he made me ask questions of myself that were difficult. How do I go beyond my stereotype of who this person is and any hatred that I might have in my heart toward him so that I could see his attempt to at least be real and to cut through all the bullshit. And I really appreciated that. And I didn't have to forgive him and I didn't have to do any big things. All I did was let him be my teacher for 7 minutes driving down Old Santa Cruz Highway on a rainy morning. So I want to share one more thing with you. This is called The Four Accomplishments of the Householder. And I really shortened this up because sometimes, you know, in the suttas, in order to remember things, they repeat things over and over and over again. There are four accomplishments that we can aspire to in our lives as householders. Again, these are very common, not hard, but they do require attentiveness. So the first one is the accomplishment of faith. And in this case, because it is Buddhism, that faith is the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the one who gave the teaching itself, and the community that comes together to experience the teachings like we're doing tonight. And the sense of faith is a faith in this works, not because, as I said earlier, my teacher told me it works. This works because I do the great science experiment of practicing the practices and trying things out, and I get results of various kinds because of the effort that I make, the zeal I have in the practice. That's faith. The second one is the accomplishment of virtue. And honestly, ethical conduct is all about virtue. And in the Buddhist teachings, virtue is fairly simple. Abstain from killing, abstain from stealing, abstain from sexual misconduct, do not lie, and do not abuse intoxicants. In fact, for me, intoxicants can be all kinds of things, not just substances. Do not engage in getting lost in experiences which disconnect you from who you are and this world. Do not get lost in your own ego story. Do not get lost in your own grandiosity. Do not get lost in your own story of brokenness. Don't get lost in any of that. Be clear, be here, be real. The third accomplishment is charity. For the Buddha, the accomplishment of charity is dwelling with a heart free of hatred, devoted to open-heartedness, open-handedness, and delighting in generosity and attending to the needy. I think that's something we can all do in one way or another. And finally, the accomplishment of wisdom. And here, wisdom arises from the first three accomplishments, because if you actually attend to virtue, charity, and faith, you are going to be experiencing wisdom of varying degrees. So for the Buddha, he describes the wisdom that householders can attain and accomplish as being endowed with wisdom that understands the arising and passing of all phenomena. This person is possessed of the penetrating insight that leads to the end of suffering. That is wisdom for the Buddha. Knowing all things come and go, all things are of the nature to shift and change, and this in and of itself allows us to let go of grasping, of clinging. And that is the end of suffering. Which, of course, brings us back to Michael Cohen, to Noah Levine, to any of the people who've lost their way in any realm of human endeavor. It's particularly difficult when someone loses their way as a Dharma teacher. When you set yourself up as someone who's delivering the Dharma, you are basically saying, I understand my humanness and I am working tirelessly to not get lost in primordial ignorance, especially when I am around my students or when I am practicing or when I'm in any other aspect of my life, because I am teaching the Dharma. You may not be aware, throughout the Sangha tradition that the Buddha set up, and it doesn't matter what school of Buddhism we're talking about, by the way, they all have confession. All of the monks, they have a time when, once a week, they will get together with one of the other monks, and they basically will talk about the experiences they had where they did not conduct themselves according to the teachings very well. And they will just lay it right out there, and there is a way for them together to go through a process of quote-unquote purification, meaning this is out, here's what I've done, possibly here's what I've learned, here's how I want to do this better. And then there's a kind of, it's not forgiveness like in the Christian tradition, but there's sort of an understanding. This is a very powerful practice. I'm letting you know this because I feel as though it is a way to be able to contemplate not generating hatred for the ignorance that some people think with, speak with, and act with, and the harm that it does in the world. To recognize the harming, but not generate hatred for those who harm, is a very tricky point. And I know it's difficult to imagine because our anger tends to be kind of self-righteous and we really get into it. It's a very ego-oriented thing. But the truth is, we're Buddhist practitioners. And so, on some level, we have committed to non-harming in our lives and generating hatred for someone's ignorance and greed and bad behavior just creates more suffering. You can know what's right and wrong and not generate hatred. In fact, you can even go the next step. You can know right from wrong, not generate hatred, recognize that the suffering that's been perpetrated is part of human suffering. You can recognize you too are human and you have your own form of human suffering, and then you can recognize all human beings, no matter how much they suffer, no matter how lost they are, we all equally have the capacity to awaken and not suffer and not cause harm. So I hope this made sense, bringing these two things together. And I hope there was some meaningfulness for you. I feel as a woman teacher in the Buddhist tradition, it's important for me to speak up. Any comments, questions?
So how do you reconcile the fact that Michael Cohen was actually harming Trump? His message was actually a harming message.
This is what Buddhism would say about this. The Buddha was very clear about what wise speech looks like. What he said was beneficial. And no, it personally may not be beneficial for someone who is engaging in that harming behavior with him or asking him to behave in that harmful behavior. In fact, it may not be beneficial for that person in the short term, but in the long term, it may, in fact, be very beneficial. We can't know this, but it could be, because it might allow anyone who is involved in these acts of harming, that he is coming forward and just basically saying, here's what happened. It may, in fact, allow anyone involved, including President Trump, to also awaken and recognize this was not helpful, this was wrong, and I would like to do something different. And you can laugh, but it can't ever happen is part of the hatred that I'm trying to invite you all not to have, because that my small human mind can't even come close to the magnitude of possibility in this world. And since everything changes, there are many ways to be able to drop into a truth that does not include, that can't possibly happen. I just know that this is beneficial, even if in the short term it rubs up against our president's ego. But again, that's not something I'm willing to generate hatred about. Thank you. You just segue into my ending. Remember, Angulimala walked around with a necklace of bloody fingers that he'd cut off from the people he met on the street, and, you know, this is just what he did. He was just horrible, and everyone was afraid of him until he met the Buddha. Renounced all of that, actually became his attendant for a while. These are some of the verses Angulimala would go around and teach. Here's a couple of the things that he would teach. Who once did live in negligence and then is negligent no more, he illuminates the world like the moon freed from a cloud. Who checks the evil deeds he did by doing wholesome deeds instead, he illuminates the world like the moon freed from a cloud. There are some that tame with beatings, some with goads, some with whips. But I was tamed by such alone who has no rod nor any weapon. Harmless is the name I bear, who was dangerous in the past. The name I bear today is true. I hurt no living being at all. I thank you so much.